Welcome to NBI Quick Take. My name is Terry Demick, Head Portfolio Manager for National Bank Investments. I'll be your host for a three-part series focused on real assets. First of all, a disclaimer. BNY Mellon Asset Management Canada Limited is the portfolio manager of the NBI Global Real Asset Income Strategy, and its affiliate, Mellon Investment Corporation, is the sub-advisor. Today, we are joined by Mellon portfolio managers Jim Lydotis and Brock Campbell to chat about real assets. This discussion is for general information only and should not be taken as advice or a recommendation to purchase individual securities. My guest for this first podcast is Brock Campbell, co-manager of the NBI Global Real Assets Income Fund. Hi, Brock.
Hi, Terry.
So let's start with, you know, the basics, two basic questions. What are real assets and why are they attractive?
Yeah, sure, Terry. So, you know, there's three reasons why we want to own infrastructure assets or real asset equities. But first, let's just discuss what we mean when we say real assets. So what we're talking about are companies that have three key characteristics. First, these are asset owning or rent collecting business models. You know, these are often natural monopolies with a high degree of upfront capital investments required. And with that, generally a degree of guaranteed revenues to recover and return on those investments. Second, these are companies that generate stable cash flows. Think of companies like utilities, transportation infrastructure, energy pipelines with long-term contracts. These are some of the most defensive assets in the world. The services these assets provide are generally removed from the business cycle, and they enjoy relatively inelastic demand. As a result, the cash flows coming off of these businesses are incredibly stable, which makes them a natural source for income-paying businesses. And the last characteristic is regulatory predictability. All of these businesses are heavily regulated, and this regulation serves as a further barrier to entry. Understanding the regulatory framework and the motivations of the respective regulator, that's a key part of our analysis. So why does anyone want to own them? Well, these assets historically are less economically sensitive. So when the world changes, their cash flows typically do not. You know, stable services with stable end demand leads to stable cash flows supporting stable dividends. These assets are also incredibly long dated. So if you build a pipeline or a toll road, you need to pay a lot of money up front to put that asset in place. But once it's in place, it requires very little capital going forward. People often look at these as rent collecting business models because, you know, that's really what they are. So these characteristics all lend themselves to be more stable businesses that generate more stable income, which makes them a natural spot for the income generating part of a portfolio.
Thanks, Brock. That was a really good description. So let's start with one of the categories that's really important in real assets, utilities. So tell me, how do utilities make a profit?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, utilities are a hallmark asset in the infrastructure space. They exhibit all the characteristics we talk about when we're discussing infrastructure: stability of earnings, consistent income generation, downside protection. And these attributes are really a function of a utility's very unique business structure. They are what we refer to as a natural monopoly. You know, what does that mean? Well, it's generally accepted that consumers benefit from competition, where companies compete against each other to provide the highest quality product at the lowest price. While those are the objectives of a utility too, under their structure, having competition, you know, wouldn't make sense. So let's look at this in practical terms. You know, look outside your window. There's one set of power lines going down your street. Would it make sense to have two or three or maybe even four set of power lines? No. So this means the industry is a natural monopoly where it naturally makes sense to have only one competitor. Obviously, monopolistic structures could lead to outsized profits for the industry. So one caveat or requirement for acceptance of this structure is a heavy regulatory presence. The structure under which utilities are regulated is called cost of service regulation, which essentially means utilities are able to earn a reasonable return on investments they make. The reasonable return is key to understanding the profitability of a utility, and that is set during a process called a rate case. You know, without diving too deep into the details, the rate case, it's much like a court case, where you have two sides present their case to the Public Utility Commission, or PUC. On the one side, you have the utility presenting why they feel their rates should be set at a certain level. And on the other side, you have a consumer-focused arm countering the utility proposal, you know, with a lower level of accepted return. The commission listens to both sides, weighs the arguments, and generally comes up with some agreement in between the two. In addition to the allowed return, the regulatory construct dictates approval of capital expenditures, which, as a reminder, utilities are able to earn a return of and a return on its investment. So they naturally want to spend as much as possible. So from this rate case, you can see now we have clarity on two key elements of utilities' earnings power. First, the size of the asset pool they can earn a return on, also called a rate base. And second, the allowed level of return they can receive on these assets, called the allowed return on equity. You know, that's really a big picture review of how utilities make money. But one clear takeaway is, as utilities spend more, they also earn more, which generally speaking should promote infrastructure investments.
Now, you and Jim and the team at Mellon select stocks. So for utilities, what makes a good investment and what doesn't make a good investment?
Yeah, Terry, we like to pride ourselves on being stock pickers, and there are many factors that go into our analysis of a good utility versus a bad utility. But clearly, one key element of this analysis is the regulatory construct. Again, this is the agreement between the company and the regulator that provides a framework for how much a company can invest and how much they can earn on that capital invested. And there are many factors that are implicit in this analysis. So some key ones we watch are, you know, reliability of service, price inflation to the consumer, and efficiency. Generally speaking, a well-run utility that provides reliable service at a reasonable price should have a favorable regulatory construct. You know, our analysis does not entirely focus on those companies with very strong regulatory constructs. You know, though, to be fair, these companies can have the ability to enjoy stable growth, but we also look at the companies that may have weak regulatory constructs where we envision a path for that construct to improve. Generally speaking, companies with weak regulatory constructs trade at discount valuations. And if we can successfully predict an improvement in that regulatory construct, then shares tend to recover from that discounted valuation level, leading to possible outperformance relative to the broader group. Lastly, we should also point out that some utilities have underappreciated growth opportunities, especially given the recent trends towards decarbonization. And to be honest, Terry, recently, we've been finding more and more of these growth opportunities for the fund.
Now, you talked a lot about capital spending that is, you know, very important for utilities. So what do they need to do to stay operational, and who pays for this?
Yeah, Terry. So unfortunately, all these things we want, things like smart grids and renewable energy, not to mention turning on the lights, it all needs to be paid for. Utilities are capital intensive businesses. They have vast networks of distribution and transmission lines, as well as many generating units that all require consistent investment. There's considerable capital required to maintain these businesses, though there's also a good deal of growth capital that is required to be spent just to ensure future reliability. Utility capital investments are conducted through long-term analysis. Many of these assets have duration in the decades. So when a utility embarks on a capital program, it's gone through a very thorough and a very thoughtful analysis. At the end of the day, as I noted earlier, the utilities are able to earn a fair return on these investments as stated under the regulatory construct. Ultimately, these investments are recovered through electric rates. So this allowed return on investments plus all the costs associated with delivering electricity, things like fuel, operations and maintenance, taxes, interest, et cetera, they're all rolled into that final electric rate that you and I pay. The goal of that regulator is to set up a regulatory framework that provides for safe and reliable power at the lowest possible cost. This balancing act is key to understanding how fast the utility can grow, because if bill inflation is too high, it is unlikely the utilities will be able to spend as fast. And if utility cannot spend as fast, that's going to impact their growth.
Now, you know, we hear about electric outages in the last few weeks. So can you tell us, you know, what is the physical and economic state of the electric grid in North America? And maybe what are the implications from secular changes, you know, renewable energy, electric vehicles, decentralization, and maybe ESG issues?
Yeah, great question, Terry. So utilities are very localized businesses, and the quality of the infrastructure is also very localized, meaning some utilities have much better infrastructure in place than others. Despite this, in the U.S., the American Society of Civil Engineers took a stab at looking at the infrastructure assets across the country and gave the broad U.S. energy infrastructure assets a D+. So not the best rating, and much of that poor showing was that the U.S. grid relies upon infrastructure built during the 50s and 60s, which is getting beyond its useful life. Having a grid that operates reliably is a pure necessity, and this was made all too apparent most recently during the blackouts in California. To rectify this underinvestment, we're going to have to spend a lot on the grid. In fact, the American Society of Civil Engineers estimates our infrastructure will be underfunded by some $177 billion. I would point out that this could actually underestimate the ultimate funding requirement, given emerging decarbonization goals. We have a fundamental belief that aging infrastructure, coupled with secular trends of decarbonization, will result in a period of growth for utilities well in excess of historical averages. The big secular theme impacting the group, which we've been broadly labeled energy transition, describes our shift away from consuming molecules to power things, i.e. burning fossil fuels, to instead consuming clean electrons, i.e. powering everything with renewable sources of electricity. This will unleash huge capital investment opportunities for our utilities, and the duration of this trend will be measured in decades. We're already seeing the signs of this with a recent statement from the U.S. energy company where they announced a $43 billion investment program over the next 15 years to help transition them to clean energy. We expect many companies will follow this path of announcing very large capital programs with very long visibility. We believe renewable energy is entering the growth sweet spot, with very compelling demand from governments, corporates, and consumers, coupled with dramatic declines in costs. For example, both wind and solar costs have dropped by around 80% since 2010. And in many places across the U.S., these sources of electricity are now cheaper than fossil fuel.
So wait a second, Brock. I just want to make sure I heard this part correctly. You're saying that wind and solar today are cheaper than fossil fuels? I guess these assets can be good for the environment and good for the pocketbook as well.
Oh, 100%, Gary. And that's the clear inflection point that we are seeing in the market. And that's why we are so bullish on renewable energy. So, yeah, in many parts of the U.S., a regulator can retire a dirty coal plant and replace it with wind or solar and save the consumer money. We believe that is an extremely compelling proposition and one that will unleash a massive build-out of renewable energy. Not to mention how favorable this trend is for ESG scores, particularly the environmental score. While the utility group has historically been one of the largest emitters in the economy, this energy transition will go a long way to cleaning up their act. You know, additionally, with all these renewables coming online, the grid needs to become much more dynamic. The wind doesn't always blow and the sun doesn't always shine, so the grid needs to be able to cope with these disruptions. The recent blackouts in California actually highlight some of the issues with renewable energy. The state gets a lot of their electricity from renewables, especially solar. And when the solar resource isn't as strong, say at dusk, the grid actually needs to import electricity from other states. The problem recently was that the areas where the state typically imports power from were also going through a heat wave, and there just wasn't enough power to be exported. We think storage could have helped ease some of these issues. We have seen batteries where, again, prices there have fallen precipitously, now being installed in concert with renewables. For utility, this changes the profile of the renewable asset from intermittent to one that is more firm, and that is a very valuable change for reliability. We're also encouraged by new technologies outside of batteries, notably green hydrogen. More to come on the green hydrogen front, but we think it could soon become a key piece in reshaping the global energy landscape. You know, we've talked a lot about changes on the supply side of electricity with renewable energy and battery storage, but there are equally big changes on the demand side with electric vehicles. So we're very encouraged about the demand prospects that EVs present, but we're also very concerned that the current grid is not suited to handle high levels of electric vehicle penetration. We believe to get the grid ready for this new demand, the grid will require big investments and, importantly, technological improvements. As a result, one area that we are becoming increasingly bullish on is the digitalization of the grid, or also known as building a smart grid. With a smart grid, we believe utilities can better serve the shifting dynamics of intermittent renewable energy, battery integration, and electric vehicle load shaping. To be clear, You know, this is a massive task for the utility space, but we believe there's a roadmap for success here and see the result, a decades-long investment opportunity for the group and above-average growth opportunity for investors.
Thank you, Brock, for taking time with us today. You really gave us a lot of detailed information. So on this podcast, we learned about real assets and specifically about utilities. These assets offer stable, predictable returns, and they're now investing in renewable energy, which is will be good for our planet. So definitely learned a lot and definitely see that, it needs a lot of research, a lot of analysis to be able to select the right companies in this universe. So this is the end of our first podcast on real assets. Thank you very much and have a great day.